Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 14th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Evelyn Strang, and she will be speaking on celebrating the creation, even rocks and water. Let's listen in.
The idea has been to try to get some biblical perspective on what might be said about our natural world in terms of the attitude toward it. Because the religious institutions have been accused of perhaps causing environmental problems by the attitude that we are to have dominion. I hope you look at the bulletin board, the kiosk at front. It's a marvelous satirical article by Garrison Keillor. About Minnesota, where, of course, if you know Garrison Keillor, you know what he's trying to do. But what he's saying in this article, it would be the epitome of what someone would perhaps want to do for the sake of money, to completely change nature around, to drain Lake Superior, because you could make a lot of money providing water to the Southwest, like filling up the Grand Canyon or something, so there'd be plenty of water. The whole thing, I think, illustrates the human dominion over nature running amok. And of course, all in Garrison Keillor's wonderful imagination. The emphasis we've had in using scripture, and we will need to use Bibles, I think, for reference today to some extent, if you don't mind. Somebody, thank you, Merle Howard. The idea of looking at stories and seeing, for example, in Genesis 1, the repetition of it was good. It was good, the creation. And we tried to emphasize that. In a previous session, we emphasized that the idea of having dominion does not necessarily mean to clobber, to exploit. But having dominion means perhaps compassionate shepherding, caring for the earth. And we've also reviewed how sometimes nature itself has been worshipped. The scriptures throughout, Hebrew scriptures, make very clear that nature shows the glory of God, but nature is not to be worshipped. A quotation that we used before, which I think is worth repeating, and this is from Walter Brueggemann in relation to Psalm 8, where also the idea of thou hast put all things under his feet. The praise of God without human authority is abdication and leaving it all to God. I think there are places in the world where perhaps religion, I'm not saying Christianity, but perhaps religion is saying these things are always going to happen. There will always be floods. There will always be disasters. It's God's will. Let's leave it all to God. And there are parts of the world where this kind of thing happens. I mean, it's all God's will or the gods, whatever their faith is. This is, we just accept blindly all kinds of disasters, floods, and so on, and just let it happen. But the other side, and the other point of the opposite of that would be to use human power without the context of praise of God is to profane human regency over creation. And so usurp more than has been granted. Without praise of God, that's the perspective. The creation, God's, the writers say God saw it as good. The perspective of seeing the creation as good and as God as in charge. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Lynn White Jr., who wrote the seminal article that caused so much discussion about is Western Christianity responsible for the ecologic crisis, concluded that article by saying, but the good patron saint for ecology would be Saint Francis, because Saint Francis had the idea of looking at all of creation and seeing the praise that the different aspects of creation could give. One person that I don't know enough about, but that some of you may know more about than I do, is Hildegard of Bingen. And I've read some things about her. You know that she lived in the 11th century. And so we're discovering particularly also some of these women. And it's been said that she was awakened to the divine in nature in tune with the symphony of the universe, that she was deeply ecological in her spirituality. Perception of the universe as an entity and seeing that the sacramental nature of the universe, seeing that as filled with God. And Hildegard of Bingen is quoted in translation as having said, "There is no creation that does not have a radiance. All creation is awakened, called by the resounding melody, God's invocation of the world." All creation. Okay, some years ago in our local paper in Seguin, Texas, there was a story in one of these little columns about a family that had made a trip to the West Coast. And the teenager in the family was quoted about details of this trip. And the teenager was very much excited about what they had seen in Hollywood. For example, the homes of the stars, of famous movie stars, and some big things like that. And then she added, "Oh yeah, we also went to the Grand Canyon. It's just a big hole in the ground." That is blasphemy in my book, to call the Grand Canyon a big hole in the ground, just a big hole, to me qualifies as blasphemy. Now, I am sorry that someone like this teenager had not been awakened to what is there. Geologically, in itself, it's so profound, but also in terms of being able to celebrate that wonderful creation. And a little cartoon that I like to use, I'll tell you about it and then pass it around. It's a Peanuts cartoon, and here is a Snoopy. And Snoopy is walking along and says, "I think it's a sin to be bored. Just look at the world around you. Just think of all the wonderful things out there for us to see." Well, yes, if that rock wasn't in the way. And today's topic is even rocks and water in celebrating the creation. All right, the natural environment, I think, is an important factor in the way people have perceived their deities. And I think that's also true for Hebrew scriptures. You can look at Egypt, and we'll just have a few illustrations of environment here. You can look at Greece. You can look at Israel and that area. And the natural environment is a factor in how they perceived what was great, what was powerful, what was mysterious. I think that would probably be true for most cultures. Let's just illustrate that for a moment. If somebody would put the lights out for us, Don, if you don't mind switching on the projector, I appreciate it. I'll try to move out of the way a little bit more. Thank you. Obviously, the arid lands here, this is Egypt, Upper Egypt, Nubian Desert. When you think about Egypt and the gift of the Nile, the importance of water in a place like this was going to be pretty significant. That you could see how the water itself, the crocodiles, anything related to the water, was significant in Egyptian religion. I mean, the environment just sort of suggests that, because you don't live very well in that Nubian desert. And so the idea of the physical setting, I think, influences the expression of the religion. pathway that connected the Nile, everything, all the stories. There's so much that the important ceremonial sites were close to the Nile, not only the pyramids, but the Valley of the Kings, where we had the one picture of Hatshepsut temple and so on. I think that's fairly obvious. The lotus and the papyrus used in monuments, plants that were significant. The papyrus for one part of Egypt, the lotus for another part of Egypt, and the unified kingdom using both of those symbols in there. But there were religious symbolism. And perhaps some of the important animals. Horus, the falcon here, shown at this marvelous temple at Edfu. All right? This was a part of the environment which was significant and which entered into their religion, into their art. The columns themselves represented perhaps some of the plants of the Nile. And I think that is shown very clearly. If you take Greece, a very fairly rocky area, most places fairly dry, but that the high sites always, like for the Acropolis, for the Parthenon, of course, using the materials that they had, but significant sacred sites very often were on hilltops, as in the Acropolis. Always on a high place, very often. Probably the most significant site in Greece was Mount Parnassus. And there are all kinds of stories about Mount Parnassus, of what is supposed to have happened. There are also Mount Olympus, perhaps more, but the home of the god. But here, this is the part of the story that developed in their religious mythology, that this was the site where Prometheus first discovered the use of fire. And Jupiter was then jealous and inflicted upon humankind different ailments and threatened them with a flood. And so Prometheus took refuge on Mount Parnassus. And this pair was saved, and the race of arose from the stones around there. I mean, that's some of the old Greek stories that you read. I think there's something about this area, Delphi, which became really an important spiritual center, that still has an aura of spirituality. Some of you have been to Delphi. I felt I was in a holy place, even though it was somebody else's religion. There's something about the natural setting here which was powerful. And idea of, there was once a big dragon up here is one of the stories. And that the mother of Apollo called out on her son for assistance, and Apollo got rid of the dragon. So one of the big features then would be like the temple of Apollo up on the hill. And so these sites, you have to be a pretty good hiker to get up these things in a hot day. I mean, they're way on top. But the hills, looking up at the hills as holy places, was very much in the whole picture of Greek religion and the different stories. And this stadium at the very top of Delphi is quite a hike up at the top. But they were willing to do that because it was related to a place sacred to the gods, but in this wonderful setting that inspired something in themselves. And then, of course, as we look at the background for our biblical stories, those of you who've been to Israel and a little beyond, you know how arid it is. This is Arad, and I wondered what in the world those sheep were finding there to eat. Some of the ancient cities that were there. But again, barrenness, the topography, if there's a distinct feature in the topography, it would be noted. Mount Tabor, it would be a significant site for something or the other. Or the whole idea of this land of this is around Moab. It all figured in how people looked at their relationship to God. And particularly David's city, Jerusalem, a city set on a hill cannot be hid. The idea of the steepness of this hillside right here, the old Jebusite city and so on, all of this ties in the natural environment. And then water, obviously. Now, the water of the Dead Sea, looking over to Jordan, not very usable. But again, it enters in terms of some pictures. And then the Jordan itself as a life-giving stream. In Jesus' ministry, the use of the Jordan for baptism and so on. My contention is, that's all of the slides right now, thank you, is that the natural environment has a good deal to do with how people perhaps image attributes of their God, if not the God himself or herself. Sometimes the object in nature becomes the God, but in Hebrew scriptures, the imagery. Let's illustrate this as far as we've said rocks. We're going to use the Psalms particularly in some other areas. Topography, all of you know this one. I don't think we even have to look it up. But Psalm 121, I will lift up my eyes to the hills. Okay, now in some religions, the hills themselves might have perhaps been worshipped. I won't make that judgment for somebody else. But here the psalm writer is saying, all right, but do look up. Lift your sights to the hills. But where does help come from? From the Lord who made heaven and earth. And I think that's very clear. There are many specific references, thank you. Mountains and rocks and so on are used symbolically as illustrating the stability and the grandeur of God. For example, Psalm 95. And if someone would care to read the first five verses for us. Psalm 95.
Come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God, is a great God, and a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, for his hands formed the dry land.
Thank you. In praise, how do you express the greatness of the one you're praising? Now notice, the rock of our salvation, there's something very solid. You can use a Bible concordance and find all kinds of references to rock. God is rock, the solidity. But also trying to express the greatness of God. All right, just think of deep valleys, high mountains. In our last session, I illustrated Psalm 104, which has a lot of that. The heights and the depths, the physical environment, is a way of not describing, but suggesting the greatness of God, the special things. For example, Psalm 18, verse 31, is another one of those where the environment suggests the imagery of how we praise God, perhaps. Psalm 18, verse 31. Anyone have that? Mm-hmm. Please, whoever.
Just that one verse, right. For who is God but the Lord, and who is a rock except our God?
All right. A rock is a stable place, a solid place. Now, geologically, they're not that solid because our language breaks down, and rocks over a period of time, you know, will weather and erode and wash away. But the picture of stability. And in Psalm 31, while we're flipping through the Psalms, it's just another one of these references. First three verses, please, if someone has that.
In thee, O Lord, do I seek refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In thy righteousness, deliver me. Incline thy ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be thou a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. Yea, thou art my rock and my fortress, for thy name's sake, lead me and guide me.
Thank you. That's not the end of the verse, but there's the imagery. Now, this is supposed to be a psalm of David, but when he was being hunted down by enemies, or maybe even by his own son, where did he hide? See, in a cave or in among the rocks, the idea. Nowadays, We don't look to play hiding places in a rock for our security. But if you take the times and the environment, you can see how that would be such a place. Psalm 61, verse 2.
From the end of the earth will I cry unto thee when my heart is overwhelmed. Lead me to the rock that is higher than I.
Thank you. The rock that is higher than I. Human beings need something beyond themselves. And how do you describe the God who is greater than we are? Well, if you're in a fairly barren land and where rocks and mountains stick out, there's where some of your imagery comes. And right in the next psalm, Psalm 62, verse 2.
He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress, I shall never be shaken.
Great. I used that verse on my father and mother's tombstone. Since my father was always interested in rocks all of his life, and I guess got me into the interest in geology, even though he was a school administrator and a pastor later on. I think he would have liked that statement. I edited it a little bit. God only is my rock and my salvation. Mm-hmm. And that is on my father's monument. Very special. Which is biblical imagery. Psalm 90 has something else. Another perspective in here. Psalm 90 is one I think we often like to use at the end of the year. You know, a new year coming in, a changing time. Maybe the first four verses. Will someone share those with us? Psalm 90, verses 1 through 4.
Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man back to the dust and sayest, turn back, O children of men, for 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night.
Thank you. I think that puts human beings into perspective. John McPhee in Assembling California, and he's been quoted widely around here this week, says, a sense of geologic time is the most important concept to get over to the non-geologist. Whether it's glaciers, 10,000 years ago, or whether it's dinosaurs a lot longer than that, or whatever. To try to conceive geologic time, what was here before the glaciers? I mean, what was here before the plates started, subducting and whatnot? Geologic time gives one a concept of a greatness and a magnitude of the Creator. And to me, when we try to box in God into 6 days as we understand them on our calendar, I wonder if that isn't also creating God in our image of the way we would understand it. And this is why I think geology, particularly a place like this, can be a way that leads one to greater worship of the Creator. It has been for me. As I mentioned, I think I said this the other day, one of my really high points in my life was sitting at the bottom of the Grand Canyon holding a piece of the Visnu Schist, which is, I think, 1.8 billion years, something like that, and simply holding this piece and saying, my God, how great thou art. 1.8 billion years, whatever, which I can't conceive in my time. So there is some of that. I think that our language about God breaks down. We may use rocks, we may use mountains and so on, which can be great and grand, but really human language breaks down there. And then the imagery of water, I think, is a very important one. We've said Israel is dry. Egypt certainly was dry. The biblical perspectives on water. Now, so often in our cities, water is so much taken for granted. In Texas, we're learning not to do that. But in other parts of the country, water is still something that comes out of a faucet when you turn it on. Here at Holden, in drier years when there hasn't been a good snowpack, we appreciate water being abundant enough to turn our little generators so we don't have brownouts and blackouts. I mean, we're living closer to the significance of water just for hydro, for power. And, of course, we're doing other little things like taking care of water. As you know, we won't go into detail. But do you know any places where water's taken for granted? Now, people from Washington State, you probably don't, right? You're aware of water is a precious gift?
I don't think many people here worry much about it.
No.
Yes. There's a few odd areas where it's been somewhat overused, but I think the average Washington certainly doesn't worry that much.
Mm-hmm. I think the government employees are pretty conscious of it.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I think in the West people are more conscious of it. But even what has happened, as you know, Phoenix is a classic illustration. Phoenix is in a desert area. And so many people, Minnesotans that I know, have retired in that area. And when they come there, what do they want?
Green lawns,
and of course swimming pools and so on. And so one thing that's happened in Phoenix, many people came to escape respiratory things, too much humidity and pollen and stuff. But so many different plants that used to grow back home have been introduced that people are no longer getting away from those pollens. They're growing there. I attended a National Association of American Geographers convention out in Phoenix a few years ago, and that's just made very, very clear that very often people moving into desert lands, because here's lovely scenery, nice, fresh, clear air, and so on, bring their home environment with them and transform it, but not to the benefit of the total picture. And then, of course, the overuse of water. There is not that much water to sustain that kind of lifestyle. So that seeing water as a precious gift perhaps is more real in Scripture, where they didn't have long pipelines bringing in water from someplace else. And, of course, anything like desalinization wasn't in anyone's mind. And that, of course, is not too effective either, because it gets to be very expensive. Let's just look at some of the water. Psalm 104, we have looked at that visually. But Psalm 104 has some marvelous pictures here, things for which to give praise. Verses 10 through 13.
You make springs flow in the valleys, and rivers run between the hills. They provide water for the wild animals. There the wild donkeys quench their thirst. In the trees nearby, the birds make their nests and sing. From the sky you send rain on the hills, and the earth is filled with your blessings.
Thank you. Now at Holden, we can see that. But people removed from where the water comes from do very foolish things. I see in my town, where we're supposed to be saving water because it's been dry. I haven't heard lately how it's been. I'm gone home for almost a week. You will see people watering lawns in the middle of the day, and it's hot, and of course the water evaporates until some city regulation says thou shalt not, and some people would do it anyway. And a friend of mine was pretty upset when she saw that the public schools were watering in the middle of the day with all this water evaporating and
well,
all
that's important.
That's very important in Texas. You better believe it. I mean, you've got to have a football field in good shape. You know. But just ignoring the fact that water is finite. And some of us have lived there long enough to know that it can get very, very serious. And with increasing populations in these places, like Texas, like Arizona, which are moisture deficit regions, according to the geographer's definition, moisture deficit, more people coming in using more water. And it cannot go on like this. Well, biblical people were in a dry region. Let's just look at Psalm 78. Verses 15 through 16. Psalm 78, 15 through 16. This is a psalm which is reviewing the history of the people, and it's reviewing the Exodus. But an important part of the story in here, they were in the wilderness. And what happened? Verses 15 and 16, according to the story.
He cleft the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink abundantly as from the deep. He made streams come out of the rock and caused the waters to flow down like rivers.
Thank you. That seemed like a very special blessing. It was a life-saving thing. Then the psalmist goes on, yet in spite of that blessing, they sinned and turned against God. But water in the wilderness, there are all kinds of references to that, besides, of course, the Exodus story itself. In Isaiah, we won't take time to read that right now, but Isaiah even brings it up again. I mean, the Hebrew scriptures will recall the miracle of water in the wilderness. Isaiah 48, they thirsted not when he led them through the deserts. He made water flow for them as from the rock. He cleft the rock and water gushed out. Water was seen as a precious gift. And like the old, what's this old saying? You never appreciate the water until the tap runs dry, something like that. Well, these people were where the tap was dry and they appreciated water. And it got into their history, into their story. We got water in the desert. It was precious. And nowadays, like we said the other day, we don't celebrate the stars because we hardly ever see them unless we're out in nature. I mean, people are indoors watching television. Who goes out to look at stars in the city? Most of our population is urban. We take water for granted, these very precious gifts like this. In fact, there's some interesting insights about the water cycle. I don't know that we'll take time to look that up, but you can find the water cycle in Isaiah and also in Ecclesiastes, where they seem to recognize that the rivers aren't full, you know, the rivers return to the sea, and then the clouds, appreciating that idea of the water cycle. Prosperity is compared to a river. I guess we need to look at Isaiah. Isaiah 66. First part of chapter of verse 12, Isaiah 66, verse 12. Someone have that?
For thus saith the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream.
Thank you.
Then shall ye, is that enough?
That's fine.
All right.
But there's a song called, right, Peace Like a River. There's a song. And the idea of blessing flowing from God like this wonderful gift of water is a special blessing. And it's also in the 41st chapter of Isaiah, while we're in Isaiah. 41, 17 to 18. Someone care to share that? Isaiah 41, verses 17 and 18.
Go ahead.
When the poor and needy seek water and there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water.
Thank you. Again, how do you describe a special blessing? Water. A pool of water and a dry land, a wilderness. And that is important biblical imagery, which perhaps we haven't thought about because we take it for granted. And the flip side of that is the desert and the lack of water are seen as a symbol of punishment for wickedness. Psalm 107, back to the Psalms. Psalm 107, beginning about verse 33, if someone will read, please, 33, actually through 38.
He turns the rivers into a desert, springs of water into thirsty ground, a fruitful land into a salty waste because of the wickedness of its inhabitants. He turns a desert into pools of water, a parched land into springs of water. And there he lets the hungry dwell, and they establish a city to live in. They sow fields and plant vineyards and get a fruitful yield. By his blessing, they multiply greatly, and he does not let their cattle decrease.
Thank you. Now, there's an interesting thing, a little thought in here. Does God deliberately turn fruitful lands into salty waste to punish people, as we understand God?
No.
There's a little clue in here. In the end of verse 34, says what? Because of the wickedness of the inhabitants. Do human beings misusing the environment sometimes turn fruitful lands into salty wastes?
Yeah.
Now sometimes it may be because of overuse of the land, salinization of the area. You can only use the land so long in some places. Some places in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, which is irrigated fruit land and cropland, for vegetables primarily, there are fields that no longer produce because they've been sort of salted out because of chemicals and so on, where the land really no longer is productive kind of thing. Now, that may not be because of wickedness. It may be because of carelessness, maybe overuse of the land. But the idea of rivers turning into a desert, diminishing, how do people enter into this?
Basically it's done because of the wickedness of the people.
Isn't it done because they're greedy?
Greedy, yes, I think so.
If we cut down a lot of forests, completely denuded areas, might that affect the amount of rainfall that replenishes?
Definitely does.
Stream flow and so on? It raises ecological questions. And that's a whole special concern. There's one more reference. We spent a lot of flipping of pages. Ezekiel chapter 34 has one interesting thought. It's not just the amount of water, but it is the quality of water that we're concerned with nowadays. Ezekiel 34, verses 17 and 18. Somebody have it?
Which chapter?
34.
Ezekiel 34, verses 17 and 18.
Now then, my flock, I, the sovereign God, tell you that I will judge each of you and separate the good from the bad and the sheep from the goats. Some of you are not satisfied with eating the best grass. You don't even trample down what you don't eat. You drink the clear water and muddy what you don't drink.
All right.
Mm.
an admonition against fouling the water for somebody else, right? In this case, it was, you know, in a nomadic society kind of going in there. But if we're looking at perspective, it seems to be the idea that water should remain clear for the use of other people and so on. And we could go a long way with that one, mm-hmm. in terms of what's happening to our water. Do you still drink the water in your town? Do you in Austin? You do?
We do.
You do. One thing I've noticed over the last few years in my town is in the big grocery stores, the space on shelves given to bottled water has increased dramatically. More and more people don't trust the city water anymore. Now, what's happening to it?
Is that because the city water is not good, or because there's been an awful lot of hype about the refinements of testing that water and the promotion of another product?
Part of it may be promotion. Part of it may be promotion. Now, when you go to Mexico or other countries like that, you will buy your water. You don't drink the water. But in our country, part of it may be hype for the water. But part of it may also be that we don't know what's happening to all of this water that flows past the steel mill, in our case, for example. Are there heavy metals that get in there that the ordinary water purification processes can't get out? Environmental problems. Water and rocks. Well, let's just review a little bit in terms of a few more slides here. And celebrating the creation. Thank you. Please. Once more. I think this is a wonderful place, the Northwest, in which we can... Oh, I'm sorry, there's a whole bunch that needs to be advanced here before I get there. That when you come into the Northwest, as people going to Holden, I know a lot of folks get bored at this and just say, these are just old rocks kind of thing. Every time I come here, I am in awe of the plateau basalts along the Columbia.
That's the way we are when we go to Texas and find all the sedimentary rocks.
All right. All right. I mean, I just, you know, I look at that and think about, you know, how deep that was originally and all of that. I just, I have to celebrate that. Now, how many people drive along these roads and never give a thought to what might have happened here? Or maybe they haven't cared to learn. I think the story of the great outpourings of the basalt, the magmatic material coming to the surface, layer after layer, is a powerful story. You know, just wondering at how does it sort of crystallize. Yeah, I think that's neat. I mean, I get turned on by this kind of structure. And I marvel. It calls me to praise God. This is outside Spokane, right? But the idea of looking at rocks and the dry falls, for example, and so on. Palouse Falls. There's so much to celebrate. Are just ordinary boulders. When you go on a hike, do you ever take a little magnifying glass and look at the crystals in the rock and just take a close look at what's on the hillside? And to think about the forces that happened here for all of this talus, all of this broken material, the idea that this is on the Lyman Lake Trail. There's some powerful forces acting here on the rocks that move me to praise. And then, of course, water, whether it's on the lake or whatever, the streams that we have around here. I mean, it's such a gift. Maybe in the Cascades, maybe in Washington, you take the Cascades for granted. Well, we don't have too many waterfalls in Texas, so I appreciate them. they're just pretty special. And the stream itself, I mean Railroad Creek itself, rushing downhill, the whole story of where it begins and so on. The creatures around here appreciate the water. Then the story of what the frozen water did to the valley, like we heard this morning. I mean, that in itself inspires me to awe and praise of the Creator. There's some wonderful stories here about water in any particular form that can be seen here. And of course, the things that you can find in the water, if you're lucky, someplace. Rocks and water, even rocks and water, yes. They can move us to praise. They can move us to celebration of the Creator, I think. And where it all comes from, as far as Railroad Creek up here, beyond Cloudy Pass, that's another place where I just had to say, slightly out of breath, my God, how great thou art, to see this. So water in any form, whether it's little tiny drops of water or something like that, rocks and water around here are abundant. And I hope that we will continue to learn more about them. And part of the study of these features, I think, can move one to greater praise of the Creator. So thank you, and we'll leave it at that.
Thank you.
End of paper.